So I'd like to welcome you all and just give you a little bit of background about what we do in this particular cooking school and a little bit of historic background about my family. My mum's actually here, she's hiding in her room, and I'll try and drag her out at some point today. She speaks very little English, and so she gets a little bit, or it depends on her mood. Some days she gives as good as she takes in Italian, and I translate to everybody that she said, I'm doing a fantastic job. That's not what she said. My family are from the region of Puglia. So when you're thinking of Italy as a boot, Puglia is the heel of the boot. And Puglia, along with Sicily, are the two food regions of Italy. And when people often think about Italian food, they always usually associate Italian food with the Mediterranean diet, and they put those two things together. The Mediterranean diet is only found in the southern tip of Italy. The rest of... Hello! Hi!
Sorry,
I'll grab your... That's all right. I'll grab your apron, Alexis.
That's the beginning of the cooking class I went to last weekend.
Yes,
and that's Juliana White, you can hear. I had a chance to sit down with Juliana after the cooking class in her lovely restored farmhouse, looking out across to the grey mountains and the dry pasture as Tasmania experiences its driest February in 126 years. My name is Rita Catoni and you're listening to Kitchen Radio. This is the second episode of a sub-series called Hungry in the Huon Valley, which I'm recording while I'm escaping the Alice Springs summer down in Tassie.
Thank you, Juliet, so much for being with me today. And that
Thank
was such
you.
A fabulous meal and such a fabulous class.
I'm so glad you enjoyed
morning.
It.
I wouldn't mind just describing what we just ate and what you cooked. So there was
parmigiana,
yeah.
But we didn't use parmesan cheese, because why would you? We used beautiful cheese from the southern part of Italy, which is pecorino cheese, which is a lovely creamy cheese. We made parmigiana made with Scotch fillet, actually. And we made a beautiful homemade sauce to go with that, because your sauce is the most important component to make it taste good. And then I made a little side dish to go with it, which is usually just to give, because I have to have time for the parmigiana to cook. So we did some cauliflower with potatoes and lots of green parsley tossed through that nice creamy cheesy sauce around it. So that's what we had today. Oh, and cannoli to finish off with.
With a little bit of espresso.
With an espresso, why not?
Fair enough, yeah. And I have to say the sauces were out of this world. I just can't wait to go home and cook some of those sauces.
Yes, it's all to do with ingredients. Yes.
I wouldn't mind talking about some of those sauces, particularly the one that had a little bit of pork in, because I do this, and a Calabrian student taught me how to do that. And the way I do it is a little bit different, but you're the first person I've come across who puts that little bit of pork in that tomato sauce.
Yes.
And it's such a lovely tip.
It is a good tip.
Yeah.
And it doesn't overpower. You wouldn't know it's there.
No, I know.
Until you compare it to something else. And I think today we had the opportunity to compare it. So we made a really simple tomato-based sauce, because we had someone with an allergy to
onions,
and so that was a good sauce, because it has the garlic in it. And even though that is my favorite sauce, it gives you an opportunity to compare, because people think, oh, they're pretty much the same. They have virtually almost the same ingredients in there. It's not a lot of pork, but that little bit of pork just gives it something else. And if I replace that pork and put in eggplant, which is what we usually use in southern Italy, the flavour changes again, and it becomes my mother's favourite pasta sauce.
So you put little bits of eggplant
instead of the pork.
Yeah. And that was a pork bone, and then some little bits of pork itself.
Yes, so traditionally it just would have been the worst cuts of meat. The worst cuts of meat were what was usually added to a sauce, and pasta is the red sauce, and pasta is a Sunday lunch. So in Australia you'd have the Sunday roast, and in Italy you'd have the pasta asciutta, which is your pasta with your red sauce. That was your Sunday lunch. And so that little bit of meat, which was very rarely eaten any other time of the year, was conserved for the Sunday. But we're talking 100 grams, not a lot of meat.
No, it was a very small amount of meat.
And very small.
It kind of gives, I'd say, like an undertone.
Yes.
It gives this kind of depth to the flavour.
Absolutely.
And it's like the first time I had it, I mean, I'll talk about it now, was in fact a Calabrian student of mine when I was teaching adult literacy in Melbourne, and he would bring it to class with pasta shells stuffed with ricotta.
Yes.
And spinach, and the sauce was amazing. And he told me in the end, you shouldn't see any meat in it. You should only ever just
feel
taste it or feel it almost.
Yeah. And it's not a lot. Whereas when the further north you go in Italy, where the climate is more inclined to the production of cattle and beef, and you have, the bolognese sauce that comes out of the city of Bologna and all of those places where they have access to meat, historically, their sauces
are really filled with meat. And, you know, we call them the ragu. You see them on telly all the time, where they have lots and lots and lots and lots of meat. And they slow cook that for 8 or 9 hours. Well, what you end up with is fantastic stew type thing, which is perfect for the cold climates that they come from. But in the southern part of Italy, first of all, there isn't the access to the meat because they were poor and they didn't have pasture where they grew it, because it's the heat of the Mediterranean, totally different to the alpine regions of the northern part of Italy and to the cooler climate of the central part of Italy. And so, you know, you don't want to be eating that in the heat of the Mediterranean, having that kind of heavy meat-paste food. So people ate traditionally everything they had growing around them. And it was just by sheer luck that the people of the Mediterranean, the southern Italians, had this huge plethora of vegetables and fruit and fish that they could access that developed into what we now know as the Mediterranean diet, and we know is one of the healthiest diets on earth. That diet isn't found throughout Italy. It isn't found further north than the southern part of Italy. You have Sardinia and Calabria, Sicilia and Puglia, and they are the homes of that kind of food. And then you start to get into the mountainous regions and they start to incorporate your pork products and your animal fats, and they aren't quite the same. Mm-hmm. So the olive oil is king. The grain is important. The type of grain that is grown is important, not just grain. The way pasta is made is so different to what you see it made on TV. So what you're eating is something that is actually good for you, because they're using the grain integrale, we call it, the integral grain, the whole grain. And it isn't the grain that we use here. It's durum wheat, so it's got a totally different way of doing things. So, yes, important region of Italy is, and I'm very lucky that my family came from there.
So your family are from Puglia?
Yes.
And they came out to Australia in the late 50s?
In 59, mum and dad came in 59. My father's brother, so 4 out of my 5 brothers came to Hobart, came to Tasmania. My father was the 3rd of those 4, and then another brother came out after him,
a
year.
The whole family came?
Bar one.
Right.
And I think he felt, years later I thought about it, and he felt quite neglected, because when you think about how important family is to the Italian culture, when they had the family gatherings, all of his family were on the other side of the world. And I think he might have felt like they had abandoned him. But we had we have an extensive family in Hobart. So when we do have our extended family gatherings, there are about 50 of us. And that's fantastic. All the brothers have had kids, and now they're second cousins and they're married, and third cousins, and it's fantastic. Yeah. It's like the big fat big Greek wedding, except it's Italian.
And, you know, I don't associate Hobart as a place of, you know, significant Italian migration. I think of Melbourne, I think of Adelaide, I think of North Queensland, but in fact there was a significant Italian population
there
here.
There was, indeed.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit?
We did. So there was a migration out to Hobart. Italians, actually, when they left after the Second World War, they went everywhere. If you go to most places, you know, Argentina, the population of Argentina, 40% of that population is Italian. You know, in Canada, the United States, South Africa, they went everywhere, because there was this massive depression years. And so people wanted the skilled labour of the Italians. And so they came out. In Hobart, we had the hydroelectric scheme. We had the road built to the mountain, up the mountain, Mount Wellington. And so there was a need for skilled labour to come to Hobart. And it was a really nice place. So I think that there probably, I'm only guessing here, but I think it's about 300 families that came out to Hobart. I think Hobart, when you think of Tassie, and this is going to sound very negative, I don't mean to, but when you think of it in terms of Australia as a whole, is often forgotten. And so when people don't realise that there's a large population of Italians down here, it's probably because they haven't thought about Tasmania for a long time. So they probably didn't think that they would bother coming here. But when the Italians came to Tasmania, they felt that it's not the place that they could grow grapes, for example. Yet we have award-winning wineries in Tasmania now. But there was this whole concept that Tasmania is very cold, which you probably think of coming from Alice Springs, but actually we have a very mild climate, and it's suitable for so many of the very things that Italians did. Even Mona, which is now an internationally acclaimed museum and is amazing, then the Al Corso family built all those vines and bought that peninsula for a song, because who wants a peninsula jutting out into the Derwent River anyway as a rubbish piece of land? It's a beautiful prime real estate. Who wouldn't want it? And they built this beautiful vineyard in there, which is still the vineyard that Mona uses. And you think, that was put in place by Italians. Italians had this ability to want to recreate their own home wherever they went. So they always, like the Greeks and other cultures, they always accumulated together because they could speak the same language. And communicating as human beings is really important. So to find someone who can speak your language is really important, especially in the early days. And then wanting to have what they left behind. And what they left behind was fantastic food, as we all know. I mean, Italian food is not just me saying it, but it's one of the most popular cuisines in the world. And it's obviously for a reason, because it's amazing, especially from our region of Italy. But when they moved to Australia, they couldn't access any of that. There was nothing here. So in order to get the same kind of food, they either had to grow it themselves, bring it into the country themselves, or make it themselves.
So what was it like for early Italian migrants here?
Well, they didn't have anything. So my uncle, my father's oldest brother, was the first of the brothers to come out to Tasmania. And the reason that he left was because he worked in metal. He did metal work, and he was also an engineer. So he knew about the movement of machinery and that sort of thing, which was the only brother out of all of them who had that skill, because all of the others had different trades. And they came out, he came out because they had the mines in the northern part of Tasmania, and they needed somebody who was sponsored. They needed somebody who would be able to maintain that machinery, and if something broke down, to rebuild with the metalwork, because he had really good skills. He actually built the wrought iron fences of one of his brother's houses, which is still there, all done by hand, not put through a machine, but done by hand. He had enormous skills. People had a lot of skills in those days that now we take for granted and we use machinery to do. And he came out here because he couldn't find any work in Italy and he couldn't make ends meet. So he thought, if I move down here temporarily, I may be able to make some money. I can send some back to my mum. Now, all five of those brothers, their father passed away, so my grandmother raised them. And so she struggled with five boys to make ends meet. And then he asked one of the youngest brother to come out, and before he knew it, they all wanted to come out. And the aim of most migrants, whether they were Italian or Greek, was never to come out to Australia to make Australia their home. Let's just get one thing right. They came out to Australia because their home was elsewhere, but there was no money at home. It was depression year. They couldn't run their families, they couldn't feed their families, they couldn't find work. And so they came out here and they thought that what they would do is work really, really hard and then go back home and have enough money to invest in a property and maintain that aspect of life. And they came to Australia. Australia was the land of milk and honey, and it was genuinely the land of milk and honey. If you worked very hard, you could get ahead. It isn't the case now. You could work as hard as you like, and it's very difficult for people to get ahead. Almost impossible at times, but in those days, if you worked hard, you could. And so what they found was they worked very, very hard, and they were able to buy a home. So my uncle bought his first house in Hobart for $700. So it was an affordable thing. You could buy your own home, and then you could have another home. One of my uncles lived in Launceston, and when he first came out, he would write back to his mum and say, well, look, it's very difficult here because I can't even get olive oil to cook with. When on certain dishes, he would go to the pharmacy where they had these tiny little bottles of olive oil that they used for babies, and he would go to a number of pharmacies because they wouldn't give him all of it. He didn't look like a man that had lots of babies at home. And so he would just get little bottles, just enough to put a little bit of condiment on his food. Now, today, you saw that we actually use a lot of olive oil because it is the olive oil growing region. My grandfather was a producer of olive oil. To not have access to olive oil would be really difficult. And also, you know, things like just basic herbs, parsley and things that they were used to. They didn't have access to the things that they normally would incorporate in the food. So they started to bring them in. They started to import them. There were two people in the little community in Elizabeth Street. There was my godfather, the Kakavos, and another Longo family, which were Northern Italians. And both of those started bringing food in from Italy. So they'd bring in olive oil and they'd bring in dried pasta and cheeses and other things. And not only the Italian community, but the Greek community would access those shops so they could have those things. And they did very well because they were giving the community exactly what they needed. Well, if you fast forward to Hobart, Australia now, you can get food from any culture on earth. If you are South African and you want to make certain South African dishes, you'll find those ingredients. You just need to know where to look. And, you know, you might be Japanese, you can go into the supermarket and buy all the lovely Japanese things that you want, even Japanese branded food.
So you wouldn't have had any grandparents?
Not here, no. I had pseudo-grandparents. We had this beautiful woman called Lisa Giusti, and she had, I called her Nonna Lisa. She had 10 children, and she was my sort of grandmother. But the thing that was beautiful is that I actually knew my relatives in Italy, even though I never met them. I was the only grandchild that my grandparents hadn't met. I met them for the first time when I was 19, first and only time I've ever been to Italy. I mean, I was born in Hobart. But I knew them. I knew my mother's sisters. I knew their personalities. I knew the kids that they had, because every time my mother would cook and we'd make all that intricate food around the table, she used that opportunity, because she was very homesick, to talk about her family. And so it was as if I already knew all these people. And when I met them finally, they weren't strangers to me. They were family. And that was a beautiful thing. Mum kept that alive. And Italians and Greeks and a lot of people kept their culture alive. And the way that you do that is to talk about it and to keep it going. And, you know, I say to people when they come to my classes, you know, if you want to taste authentic food from a region, then you need to go to those people that have left that country of origin, because they go into this little time warp and they start to produce the very things that they were always produced, the way it always has done. And the country of origin has modernised and has gone along the way of the whole world, where, you know, there's a global recession, people are poorer than they ever used to be, even though we think not. So the cost of living is so high that everybody has to go to work. Well, once upon a time, even in Australia, you didn't go to work if you're a woman. You know, my husband's mother, she had to resign from work in Australia as soon as she got married. As a married woman, you weren't permitted to work. And I remember as a kid at school, 95% of the women in Australia were at home, and we went home for lunch. And your mothers would be home and they'd provide you, whether you're Australian or German or Yugoslav or Polish, you went home. And everybody went to school within a walking distance of their school, unless you went to a private school, which we didn't do. And everybody ate at home. And so in order for those cultures to feel like they hadn't left their home, which they inevitably ended up staying in Australia, well, why wouldn't you? You could build yourself a beautiful home. Your kids were born here. They started to speak English. They started to assimilate with Australians. They became Australians. And so going home never was never something that they were ever going to do again. But never left them. And so in order for them to stay here, they went into a time warp where their customs stayed the same. There was a belief that we were going to marry all the Italian, young Italian guys. All the Italian girls will marry the Italian guys, and the Greeks will marry the Greeks, and the Polish will marry the Polish, and we will still produce food the way we know how to produce it, and if we can't find the ingredients, we bring them in. If we can't do that, we make them ourselves. We'll grow the vegetables, we'll do this. And in Australia, and especially in Tasmania, we have very strict biosecurity laws, but not after the post-war Europe. There were no biosecurity laws. Everybody bought in seeds. The British bought in their tomato seeds and the Germans bought in their types of seeds. So that's why we have such a beautiful variety of things that we can grow here, because everyone bought seeds in at that time. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's just the way it was. They weren't doing it illegally, just nobody ever thought about it. And so they grew things. I remember my father saying to me that when he first bought some bread for his family, he said it was totally inedible. And in Italian, we have a word for the middle part of the bread. We call it la mollica. La crosta is the outside, and the inside is called la mollica. And my father used to say, you could take the mollica out of the bread, and you can re-knead it and make another loaf of bread. It's so undercooked and so not very good and soft and not very pleasant. So they just made their own. They accessed the flour and they made their own bread. And my mum ended up in a rental place in Elizabeth Street having this massive Pompeii oven built in the... I'm sure people that have those beautiful 18-something homes think that the oven, the stone oven in the back of that particular one of those terrace shops was part of that beautiful old building, but it wasn't. It was built by the Italians that lived, rented there for 24 years, and we had this massive stone oven in a rental place, and mum would bake, you know, 23 massive loaves of bread in one hit, and we would bake and have lovely fresh bread and friselle and everything. She made beautiful Savoiardi biscuits and lots of things as the temperature of the oven dropped down slowly. She'd have things to go in there, and we had access to fantastic food.
In your own home? You had
in our own home.
And were you part of that?
I was part of that, yes. I want one here, but I don't have a stone oven here. And I was really hoping that I would be able to have one built. There is no one that has the skills to build the old-fashioned Pompeii ovens. There are plenty of replica ovens that are put together, but I actually want one of those original ones. They're called Pompeii ovens because they uncovered them in Pompeii, and they're exactly the same. And so they're totally functional then, and they cook like a dream. Mm. And I really wanted one before my dad passed away because he knew how to run the fire in it and work out the temperatures and get it all right. But sadly, he passed away. My mother says to me, I still want one. And my mother says to me, that she's 95, why? It's messy. Don't you have enough to do? And I'm thinking, yeah, but mum, the bread that came out of that oven with that slight smokiness was just to die for. Yeah. Why wouldn't you want that? Even if I only fired it up once a year, I don't care. I would love that. Yes.
So how old were you when you started cooking?
Well, I was very young. My sister married when she was 19, and there is a distinct way of treating boys and girls within a traditional Italian household of my parents' era. I don't think it's the case now, but there was a distinct delineation. So the girls were the workhorses. They did everything. And as a result, I didn't have much of a childhood. I didn't have friends and go out and play like everybody else. But I learnt all the skills, which was very important things to learn, and I appreciate that now as an adult, that I was in that position. But I learnt from a very young age. I probably started helping my mother 5 or 6 years of age in the kitchen, and it wasn't come on, Juliana, come into the kitchen, I'll show you how we make this, and this is why we do this. It was, I'm working, I'm very, very busy, because my mother had to work from the moment she woke up till way past midnight every day to make ends meet and pay the rent, unlike most other Italian women whose husbands were able to bring in a reasonable enough wage to keep the family going. So those women just stayed home and plodded around and did domestic things. My mother did domestic things with 5 children, and she worked all the time as well. So for her, having someone to help her out was really important. And it would just start off with, here, Juliana, could you just cut this up and pop it in there while I do this bit and I'll do this and I'll fry this off and I'll do this and you do that. And before we know it, I behaved very much like my assistant Lucy behaved today, where I cleaned up around her and prepared and helped. But in that process, for me, as a young kid, I saw how much effort my mother had, how much sacrifice she made. And there was always part of me that wanted to help her. And so I would get out of my comfort zone to make sure that I would be there to help her with all of the jobs she had to do. And so it wasn't long that I could actually do the jobs that she did from scratch. So she'd call out from the front of the house, which was her dressmaker and tailor shop. My father was a tailor, my mother was a dressmaker. And mum would call out, she'd say, could you cut up the onion and I'll be in a minute. And I'd say, I've already made the sauce, mum, because I'd already worked it out. And so by the time I was 11, I was able to cook virtually everything my mother could cook. There were some things I didn't learn. And those things were the things where I helped her along the way, but I didn't do it all completely. So things like making those fantastic homemade Savoiardi biscuits that she fired in the wood-fired oven, I vaguely remember what she put into them, but I don't quite remember. And now that she's 95, she can't remember. And things like mussazzuoli, which are these not particularly wonderful biscuits, but still there's something about them. They're made out of a thing called cotto. And cotto is, when my father used to make the wine, you take some of the grape juice which is called mosto, where the word mustard comes from, mosto, and then that will be boiled and boiled and boiled down to it's reduced down to a syrup. Then those particular biscuits were kneaded with that syrup, and that have nuts added through it and bits of espresso in it and chocolate added into it and grated orange and candied citrus, and then they were just these biscuits that were
and they're quite dark, aren't they?
And they're dark and hard, and you had to dunk them in your coffee. Do you remember those?
I know. As soon as you said them, I was like, as soon as you said koto, I knew exactly what you were talking about. And I can't tell you how I know that.
Yeah, it's just there. It sits in the back of your mind. There was another biscuit that my mother used to make, and it was made to be had with a glass of wine. So they were made with honey and pepper. And they were imbiscottati, so a biscuit means to be twice cooked. And so they were cooked once and then imbiscottati, and they were sort of savoury but not savoury, and not my favourite because I don't like drinking wine, but I still want to know how she did it.
Yeah, they're like the Vincento, which you get in Tuscany. They've got the Vincento and you've got the biscotti that you dunk in the
in
Vincento.
The wine.
Yeah.
And so this is what they were like, but they had pepper in them.
Yeah,
so they were a little bit peppery.
Pepper and honey together.
Pepper and honey together, which is just amazing. Yes, you know, the Romans used to get fresh figs and split them in half and put roasted walnuts in them, then roll them in hot honey and then grated pepper over the top. I do that for antipasto sometimes.
Yeah.
And you think that can't, you know, you've got the sweetness of the date, you have the sweetness of the honey, you have the lovely fresh walnuts in there, and then that hit of pepper. And you think that can't work, but actually it works amazingly well. And you have that with a bit of prosciutto crudo.
Yeah.
It's to die for. And you think, yeah, that's good.
So did your family do the... And you're going to correct me, but I'm going to say it so you can correct me. The passata every year, did you do
we
this?
We did, but it wasn't passata. There's a slight variation. And of course, in Australia today, we like to use the word passata. It's bandied around all the time. But what we made was salsa. The reason that, and in southern Italy, it was always salsa. And there's a slight difference between salsa and passata. We don't like using the word salsa anymore in modern times because now salsa means something in South America that is completely different to what we had in Italy. And there weren't a lot of South American people in Australia when we were growing up, and so it was always remained salsa. Yes, we used to have a day. Most of the time when you think about the passata day that people talk about, the salsa day, it never happens in a day when you grow your own tomatoes. But we lived at the back of a terraced housing in the CBD of Hobart, where we had no garden. And so my father used to get his tomatoes from Bridgewater out there, field tomatoes, and he'd buy 10 or 12 boxes, big boxes actually, not the little boxes you get now, big boxes of tomatoes. So they were all roughly of the same ripeness. They were never ripe enough. So we would leave them out, as I have at the moment in my house. I've got tomatoes ripening, ready for me to do my salsa day. And so they would usually come together at the same time. But if you grow your own tomatoes, it's not a salsa day, it's a salsa month. Because as those tomatoes are ripening, you will do a few bottles. Then next week, another whole batch ripen, and you've got to bring all the infrastructure out again and do another few bottles until the whole tomato season is finished. And it's nice, but it gets a bit hard, you know, when the cleanup after it is a mess. There is a fundamental difference, and yet a subtle difference between the two. Salsa is when the tomatoes have been cut in half. Well, I cut them in half only because they're homegrown and I don't want any bugs in them. And they're placed in a pot on the stove with, you know, a fairly large pot on the stove with about half a cup of water in the bottom, and they are softened over a heat for about 1 or 2 minutes only, stirring occasionally just to soften them so they can go through your pasta pomodoro machine, which takes the pips and the skins off. In that process of softening them, that pot fills up with liquid. The liquid is the natural acid the tomato produces because tomatoes are naturally acidic. So before we put those tomatoes through our pasta pomodoro machine, unless of course they happen to be certain varieties of bottling tomatoes are specifically grown to be lower in acid, then I put my finger in that liquid and I taste it. If that liquid is sweet, I keep the liquid and I put it all through my pasta pomodoro machine. Because when you're making your sugo, your pasta sauce, then you might need to add a bit of water. You may as well add the really sweet water that comes from the tomatoes. But most of the time, if you have added tomatoes in there that are not bottling tomatoes, they are acidic. And when you put your finger into that water, it's sour. If that's the case, then that water is drained off in a colander and thrown away, and only the tomato and the pulp. I'm not talking about pulp when I'm talking about the water, I'm talking about liquid. And then the tomato and the pulp is put through. So we guarantee our tomatoes are sweet because we've controlled the acid that's in the tomato. When people make passata, genuine passata is made when the tomatoes are really ripe and they're put through the pasta pomodoro machine raw. And when you put the tomatoes through raw, you have no way of controlling the acid or otherwise of those tomatoes. So we always heat the tomatoes first. We are making salsa, and passata is made when they are raw. Obviously, they're used the same way. When we bottle those tomatoes, we never add salt to them because salt will corrode the flavour of the tomato over time. So, yes, if you use them with 1 or 2 years, they'll be fine. But if you keep them for a long time, and they can keep for a very long time, then the flavour is lost as when you have the salt. You add salt in the cooking process when you're using those to make a sauce or whatever you're using it for. That's when you add your salt to it. The only thing that we might add to it is one basil leaf, just one, not a whole swathe of it, because that will alter the flavour of the tomato as well. And those bottles then are boiled for 10 minutes. So that you put the bottles in, you carefully put them in so they don't smash, and you bring them up to a boil. And when they start to rapidly boil, like pasta water, rapid boiling, you time 10 minutes, then turn it off and just let them cool in that water. If you overcook those tomatoes at that time, if one, you overcook them when you are softening them and you cook them to bilio, and two, if you overcook them and when you are trying to sterilize them so they can preserve, because there's no preservative in them, then what you do is you alter the flavor of the tomato. And in the southern part of Italy, in the Mediterranean, in the heat of the Mediterranean, what we are after is produce that tastes as fresh as it possibly can. They should taste fresh, like you have picked them from the garden and cooked with them. And you do that by not overcooking them in that preserving process time. Did you notice that today?
That was beautiful. It was those sauces wouldn't have been as lovely as without the homemade salsa. Yeah.
Yep.
And also, like, I mean, there were two sauces you made. So yes. You made one with just chopped garlic and fresh tomato.
Yes.
And then the salsa.
Yes.
And then the other one was a little bit more complicated with...
Yes, with a piece of pork and things in it.
A piece of pork and onion. And
now, I would normally not put the salsa in that one with that we did.
Yep.
I just put it in because I had it there and it was in my hand.
Which one would you not?
The one with the fresh tomatoes, the whole tomatoes.
Okay. Yeah, I would
use fresh tomatoes. Yeah. Would never add any of that in there.
And I think there is absolutely nothing like fresh tomatoes in a pasta sauce, but I think your point of... that the tomatoes have to be really, really ripe before you make, whether or not you're making sugo or salsa, having them ripe is so integral. Can you tell me about the tomatoes you've got? Because I'm just amazed. They're the most beautiful tomatoes.
They are beautiful, aren't they?
So I just want to describe them. They're all different shapes, kind of like ox hearts, but then there's some that are oblong. So they're all different shapes.
And all from the same bush.
Wow. And they've got these... and what would you call them? They're kind of like little ribs on them, these round ribs on them. As well.
It's hard to describe.
I've never seen anything like that.
No, they're a fantastic tomato. They're not my heirloom tomatoes from my family. So those particular tomatoes, I was introduced to those about 4 years ago by a really lovely couple, Margherita and Laurie. And they were given the seeds to those tomatoes by an Italian guy. They're Italian bottling tomatoes. We don't know the name of them, so we can't tell anybody because we don't know. Laurie calls them my Italians. And he will grow those tomatoes and get something between 15 to 20 kilograms off one plant. My mother said to me, as you held the tomato, some of them are almost, you know, 3/4 of a kilo on their own. They're hefty tomatoes. Mum said, how does that bush actually hold on to that tomato? It's so huge. I think any plant will hold on to its fruit. That's nature. But they are hefty, you know, plants. The beauty of those is that they are bottling tomatoes, so they are really low in acid. and we have an issue because a lot of canned tomatoes and bottled tomatoes that you buy, the passata that people buy, has added acid to it. So people then start adding sugar to their sauces, and that's a no-no because Italians traditionally never add sugar to things like that. They just made sure they used produce that was naturally sweetened by the sun, and you waited till that produce was ripe enough to be able to bottle it. You don't bottle it just when it's red and soft. You wait till it starts to go wrinkly and soft, and then you know that it's really, really maximum sugar in there. Take off the acid where you can, control that acidity level in it, and that's important. Yes, they are amazing because they're low acidity already. They're really sweet. And when you want to keep them at the end of the season, I will keep those in my fruit bowl, and they will wrinkle and wrinkle and wrinkle, and you think, jeepers weepers, they've been there for ages, they won't be any good. You know, they look like sun-dried tomatoes, but they're big because they've got a very strong skin on the outside. So anything that's got a thick skin, you can dry. But when you slice it to put it in a sandwich, they are just beautiful inside and super sweet. And my mother, every year, we get to the point where we get to the last one, and it's usually around about September, which is right almost the end of winter. I hang up tomatoes, so we have tomatoes September, sometimes October.
Really?
Yes.
You can keep tomatoes
That long from the garden.
Yeah.
And we slice the last one on her sandwich. Her very favourite thing is to have a sandwich with homegrown tomatoes. And I say, Mum, this is the last one. And she says, I can't believe it's the last one. I'm thinking, listen, lady, we are now October and we're still eating last year's tomatoes. You should be happy about that. But they're amazing. So they are not really flowery, but what makes a good bottling tomato is one that has very few seeds, and they have very few seeds, and lots of pulp. So that when you do bottle it, you're getting really dense salsa. And my salsa isn't dense. I think I showed it to you. You said, oh, that's a little bit runny compared to what you purchase. And the reason for that is the juice that I, when I boil it, is so sweet that I don't tip that out. I add it back in there. And I reduce it in the cooking of the sauce on the stove rather than throw it away.
Or rather than adding water when making something.
That's
why
right.
Would you? And it's always been my dilemma, you know, because I was taught how to make sugo from an Italian family in Melbourne. And they always tipped the water out. And for me, it always, I was like, but why are you throwing that out? But you've actually answered that question for me. But you shouldn't be throwing that out.
Before you taste it.
Yes, before
so
you taste
I always
it,
yeah. taste it. So if I do a tomato bottling class, and that's always problematic because I have to wait till I get the tomatoes, but I always show people, I say, look, let's put our finger in here and taste it. And those tomatoes will be super sweet.
Yeah.
So why throw that water away? It's beautiful, beautiful, sweet tasting water. But if I happen to grow a whole variety of tomatoes, which I do, and amongst those are table tomatoes, and they've become too ripe, and nobody wants to eat them because they're squishy, but there's nothing wrong with them, I will throw those in as well. But they will alter the sweetness of the water. If I happen to mix them, so, you know, I'll boil the non-bottling tomatoes separately and remove the acid by tasting that water and throwing it out.
You know, I made, I suppose, similar to the garlic tomato sauce you made today, I made it a few weeks ago just with cherry tomatoes, and I didn't like it.
No.
Very much. What did I do wrong then?
You use cherry tomatoes.
And what's wrong with cherry tomatoes?
Cherry tomatoes are what we call agrodolce. They are sweet and sour at the same time. They are not for cooking. No matter what you see on TV, no matter how many times they say throw cherry tomatoes in things, you should be eating your cherry tomatoes in a salad, on a bruschetta. They're amazing. But don't go cooking with them because they've got, they're little pockets of water with thousands of little seeds. And so they, and they're what we, when I say agrodolce, they're sour and sweet at the same time. You know that. They're sort of sweet, but they have this.
Yeah, and even though I'm straining them, I'm still getting that.
You're still
sour
getting that
sweetness.
Sour sweetness because they're not meant for eating. And the confusion in Australia with cherry tomatoes.
They're not meant for cooking.
Yeah, for cooking, sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My brain's not.
No,
the confusion is that in Australia, people that are cooking with cherry tomatoes think that they are doing the right thing because they are seeing Italians in Italy cooking with what they think are cherry tomatoes, which are small, tiny, small tomatoes. But they're not cherry tomatoes. They're not the agrodolce type. They actually have pulp in them and they are a different variety. And my uncles had this amazing variety of tomato, which I lost, unfortunately, two or three seasons of of bad seasons and you lose a variety. They had a variety that came from our area, which were literal, they looked like cherry tomatoes. And they were winter hanging tomatoes. So I would pick them in June. So in June, obviously, is the start of winter. And I would pick them from outside. I do it every year with a different variety. They hang on the vine like a little bunch of grapes, those little tiny tomatoes. And using baling twine, I will tie them up till I have what looks like a massive, massive 3 or 4 foot long bunch of grapes that I hang off the rafters in my kitchen. And they're green. I can show you photos later if you like.
But they're tomatoes.
They're tomatoes. And they're green because they're winter tomatoes. And they will slowly ripen in the warmth of my house until September, October, when everybody else's tomatoes are well and truly gone. And those tomatoes are the ones that my nonna would use in the winter time if she was making that little sauce. Mm. So she'd take a little bit of the concentrato that she would make, and she'd go and pick off the inside of her house these tomatoes and add them. Mm. But they are not cherry tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And so there is that confusion, because people see them, the chefs in Italy on their little cooking shows, picking these little tomatoes and using them. Mm. Different tomato.
That makes sense.
And that makes sense. The cherry tomato in Australia, lovely as it is never meant to be cooked with. In Italian cooking.
And so this is tomato season now. Like, I've noticed some of the roadside stalls are selling tomatoes now. And,
yes.
And how long will tomatoes be around for now?
Well, that's an interesting question. Because
mid-March?
We are mid-March. I always make my salsa about March, April. And I do that because our farm is 250 metres above sea level. And whilst we don't get any frost, we are 1 month behind what happens in Cygnet, which is at sea level. Mm-hmm. So everything, the daffodils, when they come out in Cygnet, ours will be a month behind. The wattles, when they flower in Cygnet, ours will be a month behind. So my tomatoes ripen differently. So I've had friends that have put posts up on Facebook saying, pick the last of my tomatoes. And I'm thinking, I haven't even picked the first of mine yet. And that's why I'm picking my tomatoes so late as well. So tomato season is different for everybody. But usually February, March is when tomatoes are happening if you get a good season. And this is not a good season. Mm. We have a terrible season for growing veggies this year and last year, unfortunately. So, yes, that's the way it is.
So we mentioned at the beginning of our chat today that there was a cooking class that you ran today, and we just had the most beautiful meal as part of that cooking class. I mean, you obviously love cooking.
Yes.
And you love the cooking of Puglia.
Yes.
And that's ingrained in you. How did you go from, you know, loving cooking to doing these cooking classes? Because this is what you do. You run these Italian cooking classes on this beautiful farmhouse here in the hills behind Cygnet. So where did that start?
Well, it started as a passion in my heart, but it was never going to happen because my 1850s house was very run down and falling apart around the periphery, where all the poor farmers built on their extra rooms, and it was all done with ticky-tacky. And there was no way that I'd ever bring anyone into this home. And then we managed to do it up a little bit and turn it into something beautiful. And I designed a kitchen that I love, and it has no bells and whistles in it. It's all old things. I've got an old St. George that I cook on. I love my old stove.
It's about
50 years old.
So
I don't go for anything modern. All my appliances are old. I figured that if they made them so they last that long, why shouldn't we be using them? And so that's what I do. I use old appliances, and I'm happy with that. I homeschooled my four children for 26 years straight. And prior to that, I was a high school teacher in a previous life that I can't even remember, such a long time ago. In the process of working a dairy farm, homeschooling four kids, I realised that there was no way when my last child went through, my youngest daughter, finished, that I was ever going to be able to go back to teaching, because my hearing is very poor. And that's why you'll notice in my class there's no background music. And I do most of the talking myself, because I find it really hard to hear other people. I realised that I was going to have to do something with my life that was different. And also, homeschooling and being on a farm isolates you as a woman from people your own age and people that you could associate with and have something to share with. So for me, it started off as something that was going to be a social thing. And then it became a necessity because we have an economic downturn where, you know, every cent counts. And so it became a business in that sense. I never wanted it to be that. I wanted it to just be fun. And it is fun. I love doing my cooking classes. I hate the spring cleaning of my house every week in order to do the cooking classes, because that's huge. But I love the day when I meet total strangers, and usually they come in as total strangers and they sit around a table and they sit and chat and they leave as people that know each other, because part of the whole Italian thing is that we eat together at a table, and that should be a fun thing. So I started the cooking classes for that reason, but really the catalyst behind starting the cooking classes was my youngest daughter, because she kept pushing me. I have very low self-esteem. I talk like a married magpie. No problem with that. But I just didn't think that anything that I knew was worthwhile sharing. And yet I have a plethora of knowledge that is ancient knowledge, because we come from a very ancient, long culinary region of Italy. And I didn't realise just how much of that my mother had imparted to me that isn't being taught to the very same people in Puglia anymore, because their mothers all work. And it's been lost to them. That's why we go back to what I said before. If you want to find traditional food from a place, you go to the people that left, because they still do it. And I'm fortunate enough to be one of those, even though I was born in Hobart and am 100% Tasmanian. But for me, that was very important, because I could share that knowledge. We don't have a written knowledge. My mother doesn't have anything written down. There are no written recipes in my family. They're all in our heads, and my sister and I are the last two of our very extensive family, both here and in Italy, that have all of those recipes still in our head. And so it's really important. I've written some of the ones down for my class, and I've got probably 200 down on paper. I need to get the rest out of my head before I get too much older, or I get hit by a bus or something else happens and they are lost, because they're still there. That was the way we were taught. I was taught the way my mother was taught, the way my grandmother was taught. And it's done by being part of a community of women who work together. Italian cooking is never solitary. It's never done on your own. That's got whiskers on it. No one should cook on their own. Everybody should bring their entire family together, and we do it as a group. Whether or not you can cook makes no difference. You do what Lucy did today, and Lucy, by the way, can cook quite well. But
who's your assistant?
Lucy's my assistant. So Lucy just hung around me today, and she cleared away and she brought things out, and she was part of the narrative, and she chatted and I chatted more. But she you know, we communicate. That's what cooking's about.
Does Lucy do more Italian cooking now?
She does now. I think her oil consumption has gone through the roof. But yes, she does now. And that's really good.
That's so wonderful. Look, thank you so much, Juliana. I mean, I've actually taken quite a lot from my chats with you. You know, like, I'm going to go and buy a whole lot of, which we didn't chat about today, but I'm going to go and buy a whole lot of dal and make my own
cannoli
canes.
Tubes, I know.
Canes. And I can't wait to actually go home and make some different sugo for my family, or
absolutely,
just a tomato sauce. And I actually bought some cooking tomatoes on the side of the road on
excellent.
My way here. So
excellent.
I'm just going to put them out. I'm thinking maybe 2 to 3 weeks for them to ripen.
Ripen them really well. Make yes. sure they're really ripe. The thing that you didn't see today, because we did a parmigiana class today, the thing that always blows people's minds is making homemade pasta, because traditional homemade pasta from our region where the flour and the grain is grown, that's the place, the region of Italy where the Roman Empire sourced their wheat to make all their bread. Pasta making is completely different to the way you see it done on TV. So when you incorporate this highly digestible, easy pasta that we make in Puglia, which we're famous for, with that fresh sauce and that beautiful pecorino cheese, you have something that's completely different. And I love doing that, because I think I dispel something like 7 myths around the pasta making process. There is a lovely semolina that you can now purchase at Woolies. And I say to people when they buy it, it's a limacinato. It's really fine
from
southern Italy, which I used to only get from an Italian shop. But you can now get it at Woolies as well. And I say, look, buy it. But you'll see a recipe for making pasta on the side. And I want you to ignore every single thing they say, because everything they say on that recipe, I'm going to tell you not to do. And I love that, because I can give them the genuine historical reasoning why. And once you look at it in terms of history and why did people do that, there's always a reason why people do that. Why did we start our pan from cold and we didn't heat it up? There's a perfect reason for it. And if you understand the reasoning, you will change the way you cook. You want your whatever you cook to taste better, start with a cold pan. Don't heat your oil. And you have maximum flavour. It's something people don't understand till you show them.
And you think
and
about
you explain
it.
Yes. It. And you say, think yeah. about it. You know, think about what has been lost when you have a hot oil.
Yeah.
You know, in there, and how you can benefit that. And then you run it past the fact that people are poor. And so if people are poor, they're not going to put all those eggs in pasta ever in 100 billion kajillion years.
No. Because what we've talked about today is that cucina povera.
The cucina povera.
Yeah.
And we are the region, the southern part of Italy is the poor region of Italy. It is all cucina povera. It's all the cuisine of the poor people. But when we talk about cuisine of the poor people, we are not talking about inferior food. We are talking about the healthiest food, because what they do is they eat what they have growing around them. And when people felt that they were wealthy, they incorporated meat. And meat in slab, by the slab full, is seriously not good for us. You know, not good for our digestive system, not good for us as a human animal. We're not supposed to eat meat in that large proportion. We're supposed to eat meat, yes, but not like that.
Yeah.
And so once you start to realise that what they had to eat were the things that were growing around them, which were lots of legumes, lots and lots and lots of vegetables. Sometimes my husband, who's not Italian, will say to me, so when did we become vegetarian, Juliana? Because I realised that I can go for a long time and I haven't incorporated meat anywhere along the line.
And it hasn't occurred to you, though.
It hasn't occurred to me that I haven't incorporated meat in it, because it just doesn't have meat in it, that dish, you know. And there are so many dishes in Puglia. And that's one of the reasons I chose just to do the region of Puglia, not just because it's my family's region, because I was fortunate enough to grow up in Elizabeth Street, where everybody came from different parts of Italy. We had people from Veneto, and we had a lovely butcher who's from the Roman region with his beautiful Roman accent, and we had people from Naples and from all over Italy, and every part of Italy has something too amazing that they do. And we shared all of those concepts. We had people, my mother teaching them how to make a proper lasagna, which is a southern Italian lasagna, which is totally different to what other people know to be lasagna. And then we have somebody coming into our home and showing mum how to use a whole pig to make pork products, which is not part of our region. Or somebody from the Tuscany region of Tuscany showing my dad how to make wine. And we did this massive sharing of knowledge. So the skills become really broad when you go overseas, because you're forced to learn those different skills. But I chose specifically to steer clear of all of those things from other regions of Italy, because our region is the food growing region, is where most of the food that most people think about when they think about Italian food comes from. And it's such a rich gastronomical place. Why would I want to include a bolognese sauce in that? Seriously, why?
Absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I can't wait to go home and do some cooking. Thank you so much, Juliana.
You're very welcome.
And that was Juliana White, who runs the wonderful Italian cooking classes at the Farmhouse Kitchen in the hills behind Signet in the Huon Valley in Tasmania. You've been listening to Kitchen Radio and the second episode of the new sub-series, Hungry in the Huon Valley. My name is Rita Catoni. Thanks for listening.